representatives from Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal resumed talks in Vienna for the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. In the same lines, the EU's top negotiator saying that he sees a renewed sense of purpose among delegates in the Vienna talks to reach an agreement. Also, the World Health Organization's warning wealthy countries may resume hoarding COVID-19 vaccines, threatening global supplies amid the rise of the Omicron variant. Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Representatives from Iran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement have held closed-door negotiations in the Austrian capital. Two draft proposals presented by Tehran and its nuclear commitments and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions were at the core of the discussions. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator says that Tehran underlined during the session that it continues the talks based on its previous stance. Ali Bagharakeni says Iran is serious about reaching an agreement if the way is paved for a deal. He insists that the willingness of the parties to continue negotiations shows their determination to narrow the gaps. Meanwhile, the European Union says the delegates have shown a renewed sense of purpose to reach an agreement.
I can't say that this morning that the Joint Commission delegations took a stock of the different consultations in capitals, among capitals, and they have come with obviously a renewed sense of purpose to work hard. We will be starting already this afternoon different bilateral contacts. Tomorrow there will be a working group on nuclear issues. There will be also different works on sanctions lifting.
Enrique Moro is also the coordinator of the Vienna talks, however warned that time is passing and the sense of urgency is even greater. This is the seventh round of talks held in the Austrian capital. Tehran's already expressed determination to reach a good deal that will secure the rights and interests of the Iranian people. It says the termination of U.S. sanctions is the main result it's seeking from those negotiations, and only then will it resume its nuclear commitments. Okay, now let's cross over to Vienna. Homa Lizgi is there very closely watching all of that. Homa, good to have you with us. So what's going on? At least we hear some positive air. This is what Mr. Mora is speaking about, the atmosphere there.
Yes, Behrouz, if you can hear me, I'd just like to point out that, yes, the Joint Commission session today is now over. However, the work has just begun. As Mr. Mora said, the EU coordinator, the working groups are going to start their work tomorrow, both on sanctions removal and on nuclear commitments by Iran. At the moment, we're hearing that Iran's lead delegate, Mr. Ali Bagharakeni, is having yet another meeting with the Europeans. He's in a meeting with the EU coordinator, Mr. Mora, and representatives from the three European signatories to the deal, Germany, France, and the UK. As you said, Iran last week presented the other side with two written drafts, and now, after this Joint Commission meeting, in response to questions about what the further consultations with the capitals brought about, with the capitals of various cities brought about, he said, Mr. Mora said that the sides are still going to work on the draft texts. Different texts, he said, are on the table, and the sides are going to work on the common grounds that were reached after intensive talks during the previous six rounds by all delegations. And I was just speaking to Mr. Bagheri just ahead of this conversation, and he was telling me that that is indeed correct, that Iran's new proposals, or basically what it presented to the other side in written form, which included the new Iranian team's positions on various issues or the frameworks that it considers, it included them based on the text that the sides had worked on. That was just a draft text. So what's important to mention here is the draft text that a lot of people refer to here in these talks, the EU coordinator or Iran and the others, is what was the delegations were working on in the previous rounds, which ended in on the 20th of June. And now Mr. Mora is saying, we're not putting that away. We're not getting rid of that now because an Iranian team, a new Iranian team is here and is presenting new ideas. Mr. Bagheri also confirmed this, saying that we have made modifications to the draft that already existed. And of course, there are disagreements, and Mr. Bokhari told us that these disagreements, of course, still remain on the main issues, which we all know is sanctions removal. But he also said that in his view, the removal of sanctions will create a great opening, the way he put it, for Iran to go back to full compliance. So as far as this Iranian negotiating team is concerned, it wants the removal of sanctions first, verifiably, before it takes action. And I also asked him about the fact that the United States has imposed new sanctions on the country while this process of talks is ongoing. And he said that various members or participants of the Joint Commission session were also critical of this move by the U.S., saying that it is a destructive move and it is not constructive when it comes to the Vienna talks. So when Mr. Mora was asked if he was optimistic or pessimistic about the Vienna talks at the current stage, he said that he would rather say that he is going to base his views on the realities on the ground, so he would prefer realism, because he said that it is a difficult process and there are still some serious differences that need to be bridged, and that in the coming days when these technical discussions take place, legal and technical discussions, we'll have to see if they can be bridged. No time frame yet as to how long this seventh round is going to take. At the moment, they are continuing these talks.
Okay, and Hamad, I wonder if Iran is still sticking to that point, saying that we don't want any, provisional sanctions lifting or partial lifting of sanctions. Is it still Iran's stance?
Yes, exactly. This is part of course, the proposals that Iran included in written form to the other side, and I think Mr. Bokhari and his team have been quite clear that they are not stepping back from that demand. They will not accept any interim deal. They will not accept a provisional or temporary lifting of sanctions. What they want is the complete verifiable removal of all post-2015 sanctions. They say if Iran is to go back to 2015 and scale back its nuclear program, in spite of all the advances that it's made in this time, then it expects all of the sanctions to be removed, as well as asking for guarantees and verifications from the Americans, even compensation for the losses that the country has faced as a result of this maximum pressure campaign. This is the stance we're hearing from the Iranian team.
Okay, thanks a lot for that. Tomal Leski, correspondent in Vienna. Over to Iraq, the country has declared an end to the combat mission of the U.S.-led international coalition there. National Security Advisor Qasem al-Araji says that the coalition's combat forces are set to withdraw from Iraq. The time frame for the foreign troops' exit is not clear yet. According to the official, Baghdad would continue its collaboration with the international coalition in the fields of developing capacity and training. So far, no confirmation from coalition officials. Washington drew some of its allies into Iraq in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, a terrorist group that was invading the country then. But foreign troops stayed on even after the terrorists were defeated 4 years ago. Now, earlier this year, a series of reports suggesting that a U.S. decision to end its combat mission would just be a rebranding of its occupation of Iraq. Now, let's get some insight on this. So, from Beirut, I'm joined by Julia Qasem, a journalist and political analyst. Good to have you with us, Qasem. Julia, and this is the last part I want to ask your opinion about, and this is that some people are saying that this is only a rebranding or renaming of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Do you think along the same lines or otherwise?
Well, every time there has been basically a forcible withdrawal of occupation forces from Iraq, just as it had been the case after 2007, after resistance in Iraq basically caused heavy loss to the U.S. occupation, the U.S. agrees to withdraw. And then, of course, in 2014, we saw the U.S. use ISIS as a pretext for re-entering Iraq. It's a little too early to tell what the strategy is for their pretext for re-entry, but in many cases in Iraq and elsewhere in the region, the U.S. occupation basically changes its uniforms from military into diplomatic or administrative. And with the U.S. Occupation entrenched in the Iraqi institutions and in the country in so many different ways outside of direct military occupation, such as through NGOs, through their through allies, through the institutions that have basically been dissolved and completely privatized by U.S. contractors and U.S. Presence. Iraq has definitely, we won't see an easy exit from the country outside of just an immediate promise to withdraw, which is what was agreed upon between the Iraqi officials in the UK a couple days ago in response, but again, this was in response to the losses that the U.S. Has taken by Iraqi resistance forces and Iran that have successfully been hitting U.S. Bases in the country. So it's while it's still a little bit early to tell how long the U.S. will stand by its word that it really doesn't have demonstrated will to stand by.
Right.
It would love to occupy Iraq, but time will tell how it will make its reentry again there.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your thoughts and comments. Julia Kassam, journalist and political analyst in Beirut. Now, the United Nations is criticized for neglecting its responsibility toward Yemeni women suffering from tragic conditions under the Saudi-led war and blockade. A Yemen-based rights body censured the UN for its, quote, shameful and inhumane position on violations of Yemeni women's rights. The Intisaf Organization for Women and Child Rights says that the Saudi-led war has directly killed more than 2,400 women and injured some 3,000 others. The consequences of the years-long aggression are not limited to that. The report says 8,000 Yemeni women die every year due to the blockade of the country. It's warning that the Saudi-led coalition's bombardment of hospitals has hit Yemen's health sector hard and led to the spread of diseases and epidemics. Tensions between Yerevan and Baku are flaring up again as Armenia accuses Azerbaijan of intensively shelling its military positions in the east. Azerbaijan has also reported killing one of its soldiers, calling it a provocative move by Armenia. The clashes come less than a month after the two countries agreed to a ceasefire under a Russian brokered deal. The clashes were the deadliest since the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh war. The conflict left an estimated 6,000 people dead on both sides. Armenia ended up evacuating the disputed area internationally recognized as part of the Azerbaijan Republic. France and the UK are still fighting over post-Brexit fishing rights, Paris saying that it will strive until every French fishing boat has got its license.
The president said nobody should be left. Well, we usually say left behind, but we will say left stranded on the docks. So what is missing? 50 licenses for the 6 to 12 nautical miles, and among those 53 licenses, 40 are for replacement boats.
A French seas minister made a comment ahead of the European Union's December 10th deadline for a solution to the row. Tensions have run high between the two neighbors for months over how many French boats can fish in British waters. The UK and the EU made some agreements about post-Brexit fishing of the bloc's vessels. Paris accusing London of failing to honor its commitments. Britain saying it has worked according to the agreements and denies playing politics with Brexit. The World Health Organization saying that wealthy countries may start to hoard COVID vaccines again as they're trying to shore up stocks to fight the new Omicron variant. WHO vaccine director is warning the global supply will again revert to high-income countries hoarding vaccines. Kate O'Brien saying that wastage rates of vaccines are also high in some wealthy countries. Earlier this month, the International Federation of Red Cross said the emergence of Omicron is the ultimate evidence of vaccine inequality in the world. So far, some 65% of the population in richer nations have received at least one dose of the corona jab. The figure is just over 7% for low-income nations. Democracy faces sustained and alarming challenges worldwide. That's what U.S. President Joe Biden said in his opening statement at the so-called Summit for Democracy. In a virtual meeting, Biden's hosting more than 100 participants, government, civil society, and private sector leaders. In his statement, Biden claimed that the trends are largely pointing in the wrong direction and that democracy needs, quote, champions. Washington says that the meeting is focused on combating corruption and authoritarianism while promoting human rights. That event is held amid growing criticism against racism in the U.S. and the humanitarian ramifications of Washington's military adventurism overseas.
The United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. In line with such mentality, the administration of President Joe Biden hosts a long-promised two-day virtual event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. The event on Thursday and Friday will be attended by over 100 countries. The White House says the gathering plans to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. China, which has not been included in the list of invitees, has challenged the U.S. claim of upholding democracy. Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, already slammed it as a product of America's Cold War mentality and warned that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. This is a stance that experts have doubled down. The inclusion of some invitees, such as Israel, has also drawn strong criticism given the atrocities the regime has committed against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Irrespective of the names of invitees and those that have been excluded, the U.S. military adventurism seems to be overshadowing the summit. America's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of innocent lives, challenge the U.S. claim of democracy promotion. Besides, humanitarian impacts of U.S. sanctions on countries that refuse to give in to its hegemony contradict such a claim. Ironically, the U.S. itself has a checkered record of human rights due to its racist approach toward minority groups, including African Americans. Advocates, analysts, and international observers have also cast a spotlight on voting rights in the United States ahead of the summit. A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. With such an outlook, it remains to be seen how the U.S. wants to promote global democracy by holding a summit.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration is perpetuating Trump's hateful legacy of deterrence and xenophobia, says Oscar Chekhan, writer, in an article titled, Biden is upholding Trump's hateful vision for the border. Stay tuned for more. The immense horrors of the Trump era Remain in Mexico program are well documented. The murder, rape, torturing, and kidnapping of asylum seekers forced to wait for their U.S. immigration court dates in Mexico border towns that rank among the world's most violent. The Biden administration officially ended Remain in Mexico in June, but is now reinstating it under a court order. In one key area, Biden's rebooted Remain in Mexico is even more cruel, expanding the number of people who can be placed into the program including Haitians and other Caribbean nations with majority Afro-descendant populations like Jamaica. There was nothing in the court order that compelled this. This is deliberately stepping beyond what the courts are asking for in order to subject black and brown asylum seekers to greater misery and supposedly deter them from fleeing. In the face of deep evidence that deterrence-based immigration policies don't work. Coupled with the administration's recent decision to extend Title 42, the end result is that Trump's hateful vision of U.S. immigration policy lives on under Biden, a complete and ongoing shutdown of asylum at the southern border. The Biden administration is dragging its heels and refusing to fully and swiftly do away with Trumpian border policies because they are terrified of the political cost of images of disorder and suffering at the border. Immigrants, asylum seekers, and refugees have been a blessing to the United States. But Biden isn't implementing policies that reflect this reality. For the sake of political expediency, instead, we are meting out punishment to those who need our compassion. Those experiencing the disproportionate impact of these policies of punishment over the past few decades have been nationals from Mexico, Central American, and Caribbean nations. In other words, black and brown people. The majority of individuals enduring the brunt of these policies are people seeking protection at the border. As Biden continues to uphold illegal Trumpian policies that shift the U.S. government's asylum responsibilities to Mexico, the implicit intent seems to be to keep asylum seekers who are people of color out of sight and out of mind. This is reprehensible. Indeed, the resumption of Remain in Mexico contributes to long-lasting damage to asylum norms. At a time of mass migration throughout the Americas due to climate change disasters and the economic impact of COVID-19, the Biden administration is moving to normalize the existence of miserable refugee camps and overflowing shelters along the U.S.-Mexico border. Well-resourced countries like the U.S. should be upholding international humanitarian protection standards, not passing off asylum seekers to its neighbors. For an administration that promised to oppose policies enacted under Trump, it is ironic to contrast the speed with which the Biden government arrested and deported thousands of Haitians who arrived recently to U.S. southern border, with the incredibly slow pace and seeming ineptitude with which officials have dealt with the still unresolved cases of immigrant children who were separated from their parents. For those who advocate for the right of people to seek humanitarian protection at U.S. borders and elsewhere, it is becoming increasingly clear that the racist and xenophobic arguments that paint today's immigrants as a threat to the U.S. have found an echo in the way the Biden administration is treating people who have been forced to migrate and who are asking the most powerful nation on earth for protection and support. It is not too late to right the wrongs. The Biden administration should vigorously contest the court ruling that ordered the re-implementation of Remain in Mexico program. Additionally, the administration could immediately designate nationals from Guatemalans, Nicaraguans, Salvadorans, and Hondurans already living in the U.S. for a new temporary protected status TPS program. that measure would protect them from being deported back to a region still reeling from the effects of last year's hurricanes. The administration could express unequivocal support for the migration provisions in the Build Back Better bill, which would establish work permits, protections against deportation, and ability to travel outside the U.S. for an estimated 7.1 million people. And it could also prioritize working with Congress on the adoption of even more changes to the obsolete racist and xenophobic immigration law now in effect, which, among other things, would enable undocumented immigrants to apply for legal permanent residency visas. The United States has long benefited from the energy, entrepreneurship, and hard work of immigrants and asylum seekers. It is shameful that instead of going down this path, the Biden administration is perpetuating Trump's hateful legacy of deterrence and xenophobia.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Embargo, directed by Jerry Rice. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Robey, who is a film critic for the Daily Telegraph, and who's also a regular guest on BBC Film 2017 and Radio 4's film programme. And beside him, we are also joined by Cuba expert Dr. Helen Yaffe, who is a lecturer at the University of Glasgow and has also written a book about Che Guevara's economic policies. Now, Embargo chronicles the story of the politics and collusion behind the Cuban embargo, its history, impact, and evolution, along with information from recently declassified documents and high-profile interviews. This film gives a unique perspective dating back before the 1959 Cuban Revolution that put Fidel Castro to power and led to the failed CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion and 1962's Cuban Missile Crisis. The film's compelling truths ultimately link the threads of an untold history and become the film's core message to end the embargo and looks to a future of rebuilding diplomatic and economic relations.
My father spent most of the 13 days in the White House, and he said that we had to be good soldiers and show up at school, that if there was a nuclear war, that none of us would want to be around.
All this day will bring us to the confrontation. My father repeated, if we lose control, we will not be in charge.
Dad virtually told me nothing about Cuba. When Castro came in to overthrow Batista, my father must have been pretty thrilled, actually. You know, because he could remember Batista was not such a great guy.
We've been lied to since 1959 about Cuba, and we're still being lied to today. This unholy alliance between Nixon, the Mafia, and the CIA still impacting us today.
At no time has the CIA engaged in any political activity that was not approved at the highest level.
We made it United States policy to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Wow, this is not what we bargained for. We just thought we were going to get rid of a corrupt government.
The president held out an olive leaf to Castro, and he said to him, the United States history in Cuba has been a history of atrocities, and we understand that we're going to have to pay for that in one way or another.
Now, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this is a film that takes a critical look at the U.S.'s trade ban on Cuba and the political turmoil between the two countries. And it also features lots of generous footage of archive footage and high-profile interviews with historical figures and celebrities alike. And Tim, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, the subject is fascinating and has been thorny and, you know, much contested for, 60 years now. My feeling is that the subject deserves a more incisive treatment than this film, and one which is more analytical and more focused on what it's trying to achieve. For me, it feels like a kind of fairly skimpy overview. It's like a kind of whistle-stop tour of Cuba's sort of greatest hits historically since the 50s, which sort of lets you sort of land on the big moments, but doesn't really explain them. I mean, there are little nuggets of interest along the way, and some of the interviews do reveal things, but I felt that in general there was quite a lack of kind of intelligence around the film.
It surely is a huge subject with lots of layers, and perhaps for audiences who are not familiar with this issue, it serves as a good introduction to the subject. Helen, if I could turn to you, as someone who spent many years in Cuba and studied Cuba, what was your take on this documentary?
I think precisely for the reasons that you're saying, it's a good, engaging documentary. It has that historical overview, which I guess that, you know, when you've studied Cuba, you know that history, you sort of take it for granted that others do. But it provides that. There's some great archival image. There's really good interviews, My only issue with it is that because it was called Embargo, I was hoping to see more focus on the embargo and, you know, the series of laws that were introduced at different points by different presidents in the United States and the impact that they've had on the Cuban people and on the rest of the world because of the extraterritorial nature of the embargo. But as a sort of general introduction, it didn't offer anything particularly new or novel, but it was, you know, some nice material and a good reminder of, you know, that relationship between the United States and Cuba. I do think that there were areas where more analysis would have been useful. Why was the United States so hostile against the Cuban Revolution? What was it that they were doing that was so unacceptable to the US power structure? So more on...
That's precisely the questions, actually, I'd like to ask you a bit later on.
The major premise of the American blockade of Cuba is to starve the Cuban people into submission or rebellion. It is a violation of all moral and legal standards to use the starvation of people as a foreign policy tool.
Well, the embargo was originally intended to wreak havoc in Cuba and create instability. There's no two ways around that. In 1965, Johnson then added food, for now part of the official embargo, and then medicine was also added as well.
I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue.
If a financial transaction takes place with American dollars abroad and an American bank is involved, that transaction is illegal. If a ship docks in Cuba to let off supplies that have been purchased legally by Cuba, that ship may not then proceed to an American port. It is a blockade that is unilateral only because no one else in the world wants to join the United States in this insane policy, but it is so extraterritorial in nature that it involves other countries whether they like it or not.
So Tim, the documentary argues that the embargo fails both the U.S. and Cuba. What were the reasons laid out in the film for this?
Well, it's a little vague. This section of the film is the bit that deals with the embargo probably most fully. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be fleshed out a lot more. It dates back to a whole history of kind of government antipathy between Fidel Castro and a succession of American presidents. And we see them sort of ticked off one by one, if you like, mm-hmm. and the relationship just deteriorates. I mean, it's pretty bad with Kennedy, and it just gets worse and worse. By George W. Bush, it's really shocking. I really thought that the film could have focused on that entirely, and that would have been a very valid approach. Instead, we get a lot of other bits and bobs of kind of other sort of facets of Cuban kind of politics and history. Anyone who hasn't visited Cuba might struggle to kind of get the hang of the politics there and to get the hang of what a complicated country it is and the complicated relationship between the people of Cuba and Castro in his day, and also between Cuban Americans and Castro, who had quite a hostile relationship to him. The film does bring all of that up, and I was, you know, in some ways grateful to be reminded of some of those things. So yeah, it was interesting to delve back into all of this subject. I've been to Cuba myself, and it reminded me of a lot that I learned when I was there.
A good point that you raise, actually. There is a lot of propaganda against Cuba, so this film perhaps serves as a good counter-narrative to that propaganda.
It does, up to a point. I sort of felt that sometimes it was being a bit sketchy about the specifics. I think there's some statistic that among imported goods into Cuba, still quite a lot comes from the USA, something between 6 and 7%, something like that. And you would think from this film that it was an absolute 0% blockade. So that kind of detail gets a little bit elided, I think, in the narrative.
And Helen, if I could turn to you now to shed more light on the embargo itself. Mm. It seems like from the documentary that the US was the only country in the world that had a problem with Cuba. And why were the reasons for this, and were they justified?
So after the revolution, it wasn't declared as socialist straight away. There was a period where there was tit-for-tat retaliations between the United States government and the Cuban government. So the process of nationalizations didn't take place until almost 2 years after the triumph of the revolution. And at the point where the Cuban government started to nationalize, they offered the foreign companies compensation based on the value that they had claimed their businesses were for tax purposes. And Canadian companies, French companies, they took the compensation. So that settled the claim. But in the United States, the Eisenhower government had told US companies not to accept compensation. Why? Because they were already planning the Bay of Pigs invasion, which obviously is inconceivable to them that it wouldn't work and they wouldn't be able to throw out the nascent revolutionary government. So that was, you know, the opportunity they were to was to resolve those issues. And subsequently, the US blockade or embargo, depending on who's speaking, has been, you know, it's the pretext has been it's a punishment for these nationalizations, but the reality has been it's always been at the center of a larger program which is trying to achieve regime change in Cuba.
And Tim, how damaging was the embargo? The film touches on this quite a bit. To Cuban society and what effect did it have as laid out in the documentary?
Well, yeah, it creates a kind of big divide in Cuba. I don't feel the doc really does enough of that, actually. And there are a lot of comparisons, interesting comparisons that could be made between kind of the American social, the welfare state and the Cuban welfare state, for instance, which the film just doesn't bother with. There are pros and cons of Cuban culture and life that I feel are left out. But I think perhaps what it would have been much better as is a much more focused one than just the embargo.
And Helen, the embargo itself, instead of Cuba falling down to it, actually, were they able to survive and not only that, thrive?
They were able to survive, and you know, let's be clear, in the initial period, that was thanks to the help from the Soviet Union. But as you said, I focused my work on Che Guevara's economics, and you know, he had a dream. He was in charge of industrialization, of taking the most advanced technology in the world and implementing that in Cuba. But of course, that was cut off, because immediately the U.S. government was contacting the Prime Minister of Britain and saying, "You cannot sell equipment or transport, you know, or anything to Cuba." So they had a very extensive trade. By the time that the Soviet bloc collapsed, 85% of Cuba's trade took place with that part of the world. And so, you know, in a sense, that trade had protected Cuba from the US blockade, from the impact of the embargo, because it could still, it didn't affect that trade. It could still carry out. The Soviet Union, Eastern Germany and so on weren't going to pay any attention. But the double whammy of the blockade was felt then in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And that's when Cuba entered something called a special period in time of peace. And that was my first experience of living in Cuba was in the 1990s. And, you know, it was extraordinarily hard. Even if you had dollars, you know, there was the pharmacies were empty, you know, food shops were empty, equipment just lay abandoned because they couldn't get the spare parts.
So the embargo was affecting the lives of everyday Cubans.
We made it, United States policy, to assassinate Fidel Castro. This was our policy, to bring down the Cuban government.
By the summer of 1959, the CIA is working with some mobsters to try and kill Fidel Castro. Nixon just ordered the CIA to ratchet up their plots with the mafia. Pretty audacious plan. It's now been very well documented, but only in the last two or three years when the National Archives found some files that really helped them lay some of this stuff out for the first time.
Dr. Castro, an American magazine published a story this week which says that Dr. Castro really hates America.
When am I going to hate to the people of the United States? I don't hate anybody.
Someone who's not familiar with this subject, some of these revelations in the documentary might seem like a bombshell, really. And you would think some of these things were conspiracy theories, these plots to take down Castro. Tim, were you surprised by this and by some of the findings and evidence of the documentary?
I wasn't really surprised because I've seen some of the films about Castro, for instance, and Oliver Stone made a film about him, and I've read books on the subject. This film does come down rightly very hard on the CIA and kind of presents it as sort of a banker-funded mafia with its own interests in the stock market at heart. And you see that the kind of successive attempts of the CIA to kind of unsettle the Castro regime and unseat him, and it goes as far as assassination attempts. But again, I would love to have seen much more specific evidence of that. You could really go into the details on that and kind of deal with it. We get a little bit of documentation, but really not very much. Mm-hmm. I feel as though it's the makings of a really compelling kind of conspiracy-themed doc on that subject, which is very different from the doc about the embargo that we're sometimes getting as well. So they kind of sit side by side a little bit uneasily. I did find that section of the film kind of picked up the pace a little bit. I'll give it that.
It was incredibly exciting and fascinating, actually, this part of the documentary. And Helen, if I could turn to you, just going back to about the assassination attempts on Castro. I mean, according to another documentary, 638 Ways
which
to
I was
Kill
gonna mention,
Castro, Fabian Escalante claims that there have been over 600 times attempts on Castro's life over a span of 40 years.
Yeah.
Why were there so many attempts, and then why did they fail?
I think two things are important. One is that the US government has never understood what a revolution means, in the sense that they have such a sort of personalized politics. They felt like taking out Fidel would destroy what was a mass movement, a revolution. And secondly, because of what he represented, and that's another element I think is missing. You know, the fact that Cuba was able to implement free universal healthcare, education, access to culture and so on. And what does that say in exposing the US model, where they say, you know, you have to pay for healthcare, and if you don't, you're left to die in the street. So, you know, really the biggest threat that Cuba presented was not the Soviet missiles that were there in 1962, but the biggest threat was the sort of threat of an alternative form of development. And that's what, you know, the US was so afraid of contaminating the rest of Latin America.
And Tim, if I could turn to you, would you have any thoughts to add to what Helen just said involving with the film?
On the subject of this spreading to Latin America, domino theory stuff, I guess, that's an interesting one as well. And yeah, the degree to which Cuba could be a kind of like a ringleader in that sense. There are films about that as well, and there are films about the Cuban Missile Crisis specifically.
Yeah.
There's 13 days is mentioned, the 13 days in which it happened.
Perhaps what's unique about this documentary then, as by first-time filmmaker Jerry Rice, is that she was so taken by this subject, and she involves herself in the journey. So from the perspective of sort of a layman's point of view, this takes you on that that journey also.
It does. She starts off as quite a presence in the film, and you kind of get the sense of her kind of journeying there and this conversation that she had with Castro on a bus. And then she sort of drops out of it, and it sort of tries to become a bit more of an overview. And she kind of comes back in a little bit at the end. But I don't want to be overly negative, because there are things of value here, but I feel as though the film is indecisive about whether it's a personal treatise on Cuba and on the embargo, or if it's more of a kind of impersonal overview of the subject. I think it never quite makes its mind up, and you can kind of sense the vagueness in it, because sometimes the film will transition from one subject area into another with a little bit of music thrown in just to kind of help us over the bumps. I felt as though there needed to be much more of a sense of structure. Perhaps she started the film too early and hasn't got enough material from the last couple of years. There have been a lot of changes, as we'll talk about, and perhaps what it's missing is that most recent stuff that would really have helped kind of build the argument a bit more forcefully.
I
think even in terms of the embargo, I mean, you know, people are talking about it in the past tense, especially since Obama announced rapprochement with Cuba.
President Trump will treat the Castro regime as a malevolent dictatorship that it is. Thank you, President Trump. You have not betrayed us. You kept your promise. I am so thrilled to be back here with all of my friends in Little Havana.
And you mark my words. And you mark my words. Whether it's in 6 months or 6 years, Cuba will be free.
We just didn't fight hard enough. Now, those days are over. Now we hold the cards. We now hold the cards. We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo.
And Helen, as I noticed, you're shaking your head at Marco Rubio. Why was that?
Marco Rubio has some leverage over Trump, and he seems to be playing the tune that Trump is dancing to at present. It's worth pointing, as a businessman, Trump sent his representatives to talk to the Cuban government about business opportunities in 1998, when it still was illegal before rapprochement, and also in the early 2000s. So Trump, with his businessman hat on, had, you know, said, I have no problem with lifting the embargo. And in fact, he said that at the beginning of his electoral campaign. But obviously, when he became a serious candidate, he had to do the done thing and go to Miami and win the support of the Rubios and the other Cuban-American politicians. And he obviously, you know, made deals with them.
Of course, Florida was a turning point in the election for Trump winning. Tim, if I could turn to you, how was Trump portrayed in this documentary, and is he shown as responsible for reigniting the hostility between the US and Cuba?
He is shown as doing that in that clip, which is pretty much the last 2 minutes of the film. That is it, what we've just seen. That's the only time we see Trump. What strikes me about that clip is that it's cut like a trailer. It was incredibly fast, and the footage was just flowing in. The music's really hammering this out. It's just, you could watch a 90-minute film just on that. And instead, we end with this kind of rapid-fire trailer montage of the harm that Trump has done. It's just, it really is all too hasty, I think. I wanted commentary on that. I wanted people talking about that. I wanted analysis of that. Instead, we just see his speech. We see it happening. And then we kind of go home and hope that things change.
But there's only so much time, I suppose, you can cram into a documentary.
Of course, yeah. But I just feel as though it's sort of, it's biting off more than it can chew, fundamentally. And I think if it had just focused a bit more, I think we would have a more valuable film. Yeah.
Sorry, I just want to add, I mean, you know, like, under the Obama administration, there were more fines against third countries and companies in third countries.
But, of course, wasn't Obama trying to ease relations with Havana?
He did too little too late. The U.S. embargo blockade is codified in U.S. law. It can only be lifted by a vote in Congress. But as the president, he could issue executive decrees. And those he did issue on very limited basis to allow, you know, six airlines to fly from the United States to Cuba and a couple of hotels. But he could have gone far further, and he didn't. And in fact, you know, under Obama, the fines were, some of the fines were astonishingly high. So the French bank Paribas was fined nearly $9 billion for, you know, interactions with financial interactions, not just with Cuba, also with Sudan and Iran. And then, you know, the fines are just endless. If you read the Cuban motion to the United Nations General Assembly when they have their annual vote, it will list some of the fines, and they go up right to the end of the Obama administration. So it was a very sort of two-sided coin.
Relations.
Exactly.
I'm afraid I'd love to talk more on this topic, but we've run out of time on the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.